Now, many of us know Roseanne well from of old, but some of us won't, so I just thought it would be worth introducing. This is Roseanne Jones, and she is a mission partner who has been working in Japan for many years. Japan, well, just a few. Do you know, should we put this down, Roseanne? Can you see Roseanne over the top of it?
I once did a Bible reading in a church, and it had this big eagle.
Can you hear her?
Stand.
No. 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 Yeah, so it needs to go here.
Okay. I want to be decent in case the...
No, it's right, it's right. Go on, that's fine. Speak, speak. Okay, speak.
Hello, I once did a Bible reading in a church that had an eagle standing and I couldn't be seen from behind it. No, it's not working. The switches are on, but there's no light glowing.
There you go.
Marvellous. Okay. Brilliant. Were you going to ask something?
Yeah, I was going to ask. How long were you in Japan for?
About 10 years. So I went out in 1995 from here. I'd been at St. Helens for about 3 years, and I went out to Japan in 1995. And I came back in 2005. So I had a year at home in the middle, but about 10 years.
Yeah. And since you've been back in England, 5 years is quite a long time. Are you planning to go back to Japan, Roseanne? Or what do you know about your future so far?
Yeah. Jesus is going to come back and take me to be with him. It'll be great. I think I'm probably going to go back to Japan. I've been back for 5 years. I've worked with Christian unions in Oxford, and I'm doing some study now at Oak Hill. But I think I'm going to go back. I was in Japan briefly over Easter for 2 weeks with a team of some lovely people from St. Helens, and that was a great time for me. I felt very much at home, and the Japanese came back very quickly, and I thought, yeah, it does make a lot of sense for me to come back and work in Japan. I met with people that I'd worked with before and thought, there are some great Christians in Japan. I'd love to come back and work here. So at the moment, I'm thinking towards going back probably autumn time next year. So I've got another year at Oak Hill, and then probably September, October next year, I think I'll go back. But we'll see. Okay. I have not prepared a handout for you, but I see some people are eager and ready to take notes. So if anything strikes you, it's not kind of ordered kind of 3 points by any stretch of the imagination. If anything strikes you, do jot it down. If there's something that you think you should take away and chew over a bit and pray over, that would be great. Something that I've done in a couple of sermons recently is to write notes in a haiku. A haiku is a Japanese poem that I've done it in English. It's not that amazing. That has 17 syllables. It's 5, 7, 5 syllables, a haiku. And I find that if I'm listening to a sermon and I write down phrases that are maybe from the Bible passage, that are maybe a particular way the pastor's put it, that is me thinking through and kind of chewing it over and trying to break down the stuff for me to remember it, that's actually very short. That comes out as a very short way to remember a sermon. So do think about doing that as a way of taking notes today or any other day. It works quite well. Although they do say that to say anything in 17 syllables is very diffic. but give it a go. As we start, can you just think about if somebody asked you what's so good about being a Christian, what's the best thing about being a Christian, how would you answer that? You can jot it down if you want, or just kind of think, oh, what's really good about being a Christian? And you might want to start it, if you're doing the haiku, you might want to start it with God helps me. Think of another 2 syllables, or 4 syllables for the middle line. You don't have to tell anybody that. I think one of the things that I think is God helps me feel at home anywhere. And when I was thinking about what am I going to talk to you about, I thought, Janet said, you can talk about anything you want. I thought, what is something that I have really learnt and benefited from in Japan is their very strong emphasis that they have in their culture on belonging to a group, on that whole belonging thing. And I think one of the most precious things, even when I first went to Japan when I was 19, was that sense of belonging to a Christian family and seeing people wherever they were in the world, very different situations, that they belonged to Christ and therefore they belonged to me as well as brothers and sisters. And so I thought I kind of wanted to think about belonging and that unity that we have with Christ and with one another. I asked to have a, what do you call these things? Flip chart things. This was my checking that the pen worked. That's the Japanese character for a person. It's quite easy, isn't it? It's kind of like a man, two legs, very easy. But in Japan, the word for a human being uses two characters, and it uses the character for person. Ooh, that's really badly drawn. It's kind of like that. That bit's not there. This character means kind of betweenness or kind of gap. Emily might recognise it. And the point is that a person doesn't live in isolation, that a person is always living between other people, that relationships are really key to what defines us. And whenever Japanese people introduce themselves, it's always, you know, even students, it's I'm from, you know, X university, this faculty, in the fourth year, and my name is. And it's you always kind of move yourself and put yourself in that context. You start off with the group that you belong to. So when we went out at Easter to church in Tokyo, Grace City Church, they asked us at the end of the service, all of us, to do a little introduction. And everybody said, you know, I said, I'm Roseanne and I do this. And, you know, it's Antonia, I do this. I'm Alex, I do this. But there was one guy there, Ian, who works for a Japanese bank. And he said, I'm Tokyo Mitsubishi Bank's Ian. And everybody just laughed because that was the right way to do an introduction in Japan. And he was kind of spot on in doing that. And I think they realised, gosh, that is that is a different way of doing it. And that is what we're like, isn't it? You talk about the group that you belong to. And so the group and the family is really, really key in Japan. And I guess it is something that we want to work at as Christians. But the Bible also gives us a call to leave our family, doesn't it? Abraham was to leave behind his family and his country and to follow God where he called him. Psalm 45 that kind of links up with stuff we're going to look at later talks about, you know, forget your people and your father's house. Your most important relationship now, it isn't your family. It is with God's family. It's your union with God. So family is important, and yet it's not ultimate. And I just thought I wanted to tell you about a Japanese friend of mine called Yaiko, who I think has, to whom family is important, but not the most important, and just to see how she dealt with that tension. She grew up in an area of rural Japan, kind of mountainous area, very, very Buddhist area, and hers was a rich family, and therefore they were the family that gave the most to the local temple. And she went away to university to study medicine, and she met a Canadian missionary, and through that missionary, she became a Christian. And she grew a lot as a Christian when she was at university. There was one other Christian in her year of kind of 100 people at med school. And so between them, they kind of thought, you know, we'll divide up. We'll make sure that we shared the gospel with everybody in our year. And just to make sure, at the end, so the day after they'd had their final exam, they had a big party together, invited the Canadian missionary. They made sure that everybody had heard the gospel in their year at university. They'd really used that group kind of network really well for the gospel. And the day after that, they got engaged, because it's a boy and a girl, and wonderfully, they were married soon after that. And they went and worked in Burma for a while, in Myanmar, or whatever you're supposed to call it. And then they came back, and coming back to Japan, she thought, what do we do now? Where do we go? We could go anywhere in Japan. But she was very aware of the needs of her family to know about Jesus. So she said, well, we could go anywhere in Japan, but I want to go back to my hometown, because who is going to tell my family about Jesus? And so she and her husband set up a clinic in this little mountain town in Japan, and they started to do Bible studies with the patients who came to the clinic. And they started a church, basically, and it's a large church now, several staff. And it was all because the family was really key to them, very, very important to them. And wonderfully, both her parents did come to know Jesus, and her grandmother, and their children as well. Their children, their two daughters, were people that I worked with in, with a couple of CUs that I used to work with in Japan. So she, for her family was important and was a really key part of her identity, but following Jesus came first. And when that church was established, and when her daughters had themselves been through medical school, she thought, they thought together, how do we serve Jesus best now? And they went off to Nepal to go and train young doctors there. So it was important, but it was never an idol to them. And I think she kind of got that tension really right. I think Japanese women do struggle in this. Children are very, very important to them. The marriage relationship is not the most important thing going on in the family. It's very much mother and sons. And so women end up spending a lot of time with their children and not very much with their husbands. And the whole kind of working culture promotes that as well. So a friend that I stayed with when I went to Japan this time, called Masako, they're a lovely, lovely, lovely Christian couple. I stayed with them from Tuesday to Saturday when I got there. And I didn't see the husband until Saturday morning. We had breakfast together on Saturday morning. But he had not been home before midnight. And some nights kind of sort of 3 o'clock in the morning. So he really never saw him. I mean, he was a great father, and, you know, you saw him then relating to his girls on the Saturday morning, and it wasn't that they had a cold or distant relationship. He was great, but he wouldn't see them during the week. The mother-child relationship is very important, but marriage not valued so much. Lots of companies would expect that the husband can be kind of sent around, transferred, you know, at will around the country, sort of, yeah, next week you'll be moving to Osaka or whatever. That's normal. It might be that you know some sort of mothers here, you know, sort of Korean mothers who've come to England to bring their children to be educated here, leaving the husbands in Japan. The marriage is not that important. But for us, I guess marriage is really important. That is the key to belonging. And you're kind of thinking, so what is a single woman doing talking about marriage? I can't tell you about how to love your husbands and bring up children and whatever. I'm sorry. But I can talk to you a little bit about belonging to Jesus. And in order to do that, I'd like to turn to the Song of Songs, Song of Solomon, it says in these Bibles, which is page 666. Yeah, Rachel just said kindly earlier, oh, it's really interesting, Song of Songs, isn't it? Because people think different things about it. Who, you know, what is it about? Some of us would have been on a Central Focus weekend about 18 months ago where Mark Ashton spoke about this in terms of relationship between, yeah, man and wife. And that's right. It's a love poem, isn't it? It's a love poem or a long love poem. Lots of stuff about erotic love within marriage. And it is six. Well, no, it's 676. I got so excited that it was 676. It is the Song of Solomon. Yeah, and I think probably the key verse that made me think, well, Song of Solomon, that might be an interesting place to talk from, is this verse 16. My beloved is mine, and I am his. And who is the beloved? Well, yes, it is a romantic poem. It is about marriage. It is exuberant. It is all about longing and consummation and satisfaction that happens between a man and a woman. And so you're thinking, why is Roseanne going to talk about that? But for a long, long time, this has been interpreted as a relationship between God and the church, between the Lord and his people, Israel. And, yeah, we might want to... 2:16. But I'm not really on it. I'm just saying that's what sparked me to talk about. My beloved is mine and I am his. This sense of belonging, that we belong to the beloved belongs to us. And thinking, well, who is the beloved? And for a long, long time, people have thought, yeah, this is actually about relationship between God and his people. And we're right to say, yeah, it's about man and a wife. But we know, don't we, that marriage is a picture of Christ and the church. And so I think it's fine. To start, well, that's a good defence, isn't it? I think it's fine. And let me just point you to a few interesting things about the beloved, about the groom, about the he in this passage, because he says some quite interesting things. If you look at chapter 1, verse 2 to 4, I'm going to read that. And think about what it's saying about the beloved. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. For your love is better than wine. Your anointing oils are fragrant. Your name is oil poured out. Therefore, virgins love you. Draw me after you. Let us run. The king has brought me into his chambers. So the beloved, the he, is a king. And as you read on through the story, and obviously it's the Song of Solomon, the beloved is kind of Solomon a little bit. It'll pop up as you read that. You think, it's Solomon. Solomon is the son of David. But then you read other bits in it, and it's very clear it's not Solomon. It's that Solomon is a totally rubbish lover because he had all these kind of wives and concubines or whatever. He's rubbish. He's not the sort of person you want to be married to at all. So it's not Solomon. It's not the son of David. And you're kind of thinking, okay, so who is this? And you think, is there anybody I know anywhere who is son of David and kind of not son of David? And you start thinking, okay, And then you kind of read on, you get to verse 7. So he's a king, he's son of David, not son of David. And then verse 7, tell me, you whom my soul loves, where you pasture your flock, where you make it lie down at noon. So he's a shepherd. You thought, oh, okay, shepherd, king, David, not David. And you're kind of putting it together, and you just think, if you put things together from the Bible, not in a kind of flat way, but thinking, reading across, oh yeah, this is kind of interesting. And then really wacky stuff comes in 3, chapter 6, just over the page, which says Solomon arrives for the wedding. What is that coming up from the wilderness like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the fragrant powders of a merchant? And you start thinking, wilderness, cloud, kind of where does that happen? And hopefully, I guess quite a lot of you have been through the overview at St Helens, maybe not all of you. So wilderness, cloud, it's all kind of the Exodus. It's when God redeems his people out of Egypt, rescues them, and takes them into the desert, into the wilderness for a while. And for 40 years, he appears to them as a cloud, a smoking cloud or a fiery cloud, and he leads them through the wilderness. And this myrrh and frankincense, that's kind of odd stuff for a bridegroom to be wearing, but myrrh, it's about death and dying, and we know that was brought to Jesus when he was a baby. Frankincense, it's about being a priest. So you put all this stuff together and you think, my goodness, this groom is pretty weird. Hasn't it got to be Jesus? At least I do. I think, yeah, put that together. And this Exodus stuff, it makes the way the Jews use this what's it called, Song of Solomon, they read it every Passover time. That's the way it used to be used. It was kind of part of the liturgy that they'd read. And so as you remember that you're redeemed, you remember that, gosh, being redeemed is all about being loved passionately. About 10 days ago, William was speaking, wasn't he, on Achan in the book of Joshua, and how he had experienced this kind of wandering in the wilderness, this being led by God. He had experienced the Passover, the first Passover in the land. He'd experienced circumcision as well. So you'd think, gosh, he had everything he needed, really, to remind himself that he belonged to God and that his behavior should have reflected that in some way. And yet it didn't. Because somehow that knowledge hadn't gone from his head to his heart. He probably didn't have the Song of Songs to read. It wasn't written by then. They weren't reading that. If he'd had a Passover where they'd read the Song of Songs, then probably his experience of being delivered, that might have soaked through a bit through into him a bit more. He would have read all this sensuous language. It would have all been, wow, you know, the Passover is really real and reaches everywhere. And when he'd seen the kind of the gold robe of Babylon or whatever it was that he saw and stole, he would have thought, yes, but knowing God is so much better than that. Why would I want that? And so this song being read as we think about redemption makes us think, my goodness, it's a fantastic experience. It's a delightful experience. It involves all our senses being loved by God. And that's how it was used. So people say, oh, you shouldn't spiritualize the Song of Songs. But I think it is okay. And for me as a single woman, it probably is the only way that I should be reading it, to think, yeah, it's about relationship with Jesus, relationship with God that he brings us into. So just think for a moment, kind of when you woke up this morning, or maybe now, but maybe when you woke up this morning is more realistic. What does God think about me? What is God feeling about me at the moment? And just think about that for a moment. And when you've done that, just take a look, just flick through the Song of Solomon, and look at the sort of what comes under the he. What does he say as you look through? And if something strikes you particularly, jot it down for your haiku. Okay, and I hope you see that it's clear that God delights in his people, that as this lover delights in the bride, he really delights in us. And he really does. I mean, some of us maybe know that that's kind of the right answer to the question, how does God feel about me? Yeah, he's thrilled. But he really does, and he really does. We are united to Christ. And so God looks on us exactly, and we really are united to Christ. This is something that I've kind of just beginning to get hold of this year, that it's that being a Christian, that the gospel, it's not a game of let's pretend. It's not kind of, well, yeah, Jesus has dealt with my sin, so now God has to kind of, you know, let me into heaven. It's, I really am united to Christ. And really, when God looks at me, he sees me with clothed in all the beauty and everything that is wonderful about Christ. And he really does. And that being united to him is a really precious thing. And we see that God really delights in us. And those of us who've been doing John this year, we've seen time and time again, haven't we, that the Father gives and gives and gives. And he loves and loves and loves. And that is the kind of God that we have. He's not a God who demands stuff. So kind of when we wake up in the morning, it's not that he's got a list of stuff for us to do or for us to achieve for him. You know, he wakes up and he loves us. He's not demanding stuff of us. He is lavishing love on us and delighting in us. And you kind of think, nowhere else in the world is there a God like this. Robin and Sarah are being interviewed by some Muslim TV station this morning. You think, well, it's not really a God of love, is it? And in Japan, on Easter Day, I went with Mark O'Donoghue and three of us, we went to a shrine in Tokyo. We kind of went for a wander. We did go to church in the afternoon, but we went and wandered around a shrine in Tokyo, and it's a beautiful shrine. It's a really lovely place. We were working with an architect guy from Holland, and we said, what's your favourite buildings in Tokyo? And one was this fantastic glass kind of boat-shaped building that is squeezed in between some railway tracks. It has to be a weird shape. And it's kind of concert halls and exhibition space, and they try and do meetings in restaurants there. It's a beautiful building. And his favourite old building is this shrine, and it's a shrine where supposedly the spirit of an emperor who died in 1912, his spirit is enshrined there, and people go to worship there. And it's beautiful grounds. I mean, lots of kind of, is it cedar? Kind of, it's in sort of cedar forest, and there's a fantastic iris garden there were irises on the desk in the office. It's one of them, yeah, irises. A beautiful iris garden, and you kind of walk along probably about a mile or so of grey, gravelly footpaths and through this beautiful arch to get there. And it's beautiful architecture and this kind of low buildings, dark wood. But it's a shrine. You go and you buy stuff, basically. You go and you buy stuff. You buy little amulets that are supposed to protect you, kind of. And there's a whole range of them. So you can buy something for, you know, safety as you drive, for, you know, protection from fire, for your business to prosper, for your children to be healthy. You buy all that kind of stuff. You can buy pieces of yellow paper that you kind of tick boxes in your prayers for, and you kind of give them £5 or £10 or £50, depending how serious you are about it. And some priest later in the day will burn those pieces of paper so that those prayers are answered. Or you can buy wooden plaques and you kind of write your requests on that, and they also are burned later in the day. And the amulet things, they only last for a year. And so you have to bring them back after a year and have them burned in the proper way. And that's kind of religion. Well, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? But yeah, so religion, it's a lot of please, please do this, please do this. And sometimes a little bit of thank you, maybe. You might go and you probably would take your baby to a shrine and in some senses thank the gods for it. But a lot of that will be please. It will be please, will this child grow up healthy and wealthy and wise, if that will help them be wealthy. That would be great. So there's a lot of please and a little bit of thank you, but not very much else. And it struck me, there's no sorry in this. And I think sorry, for me, was a really key thing in becoming a Christian. And I think often when I've said, well, you know, what's my testimony of being a Christian? I'd say, you know, it's realizing that the sorry, and then the thank you, and then the please, and it's that order that it. And the sorry recognizes that, you know, God is a loving person who can be offended and can be really grieved. And that's why we say sorry. But nowhere else do you get a God who is that passionately involved with people and to whom you need to say sorry. And the prodigal son, he started off, didn't he, by saying sorry and turning around and going back to his father. But actually, then I was thinking, actually, even more than Christianity is about saying sorry, it is about saying yes, please, isn't it? It's about saying yes, please to God. I've got a friend called Liz who, when her husband Craig asked her to marry him, she didn't just say yes. She did say, oh, yes, please, because she was so thrilled to be asked. And I think Christianity, more than it's please, more than it's thank you, more even than it's sorry, although it does maybe begin in sorry, there's a real yes, please, isn't there? And there's a responsiveness to this love, this lavish love of God. And until we kind of say yes, please to God, then I kind of wonder, are we not using Christ to get something that we wanted? I think before I became a Christian, I grew up going to church, and I thought, yeah, Jesus is great. You know, he's died so that I can go to heaven. And so I would use him as my ticket to get something great, I mean, something that I really wanted. And I think even now, I still do that. So when I'm asked that question, what's the best thing about being a Christian? Well, loads of things. But for you, I said, yeah, it's partly having a family all over the world. It's being able to feel at home everywhere. I don't know what it was for you. But whatever it was, is there a sense in which you're actually using Christ to get what you want? And yeah, it's great, isn't it, that God helps us be better wives and mothers and sends older women to help us be better wives. It's fantastic. But actually, Christianity is all about Christ, isn't it? And we say that and we know that. But it is all about relationship with him. So the very best thing is having that relationship with Christ. One of the girls that I live with has just got engaged this past week, and she's going to marry quite a wealthy man. And so we are teasing her all the time. He's also had some health problems, and so she said to him, "I'm kind of it makes me really sad when I think over having to say in sickness and in health." And he says to her, "Yeah, but be consoled by the richer for poorer." And she got her ring yesterday, and she's very excited about her engagement ring, which has this massive sapphire and kind of gold setting. And you kind of think, "Oh yeah, Conservative, Lib Dem, great ring to get on kind of Alliance Day." So we tease it, and maybe I think, "Gosh, I shouldn't be so mean because it does come across like I'm bitter, and I'm not. I'm very glad for her to be getting married." But yeah, she has a ring, but more than that, she has a relationship with her fiancé. And the son, the prodigal son, he gets his ring, doesn't he? And he gets his robe, and he gets the calf killed for him. He gets his red meat. Like that, ring, robe, red meat. and he gets all that. But far, far more important than that is that he is reconciled to his father and that he gets his relationship. That's too many. Yeah, he gets his relationship with his father. He gets that back, doesn't he? That's the most significant thing. And yeah, he gets this great meal, and the Bible is full of meals, isn't it? And of that kind of fellowship that we have with God. The meals in the Song of Solomon, it's like kind of figs and apples, and so, which is very nice, obviously very nice if you're out in the fields and the gardens as they are. But yeah, a lot of it is about meals. Abraham prepares a meal, doesn't he, when God comes to visit him. He prepares a meal for him. In Exodus 24, when they're rescued, the elders go up and they have a meal. And the stunning thing is that they see God and they eat and drink with him. It's all about meals. I think, again, as we looked at John, there's that fantastic wedding, isn't there, in John 2, where masses of wine is provided. And Jesus is always kind of running around eating and is called a glutton. And so there's a real richness, isn't there, in the fellowship that we enjoy with him. And then there'll be the heavenly banquet where kind of the shroud of death is kind of ripped off. You know, everybody gets up out of their graves and they have a big party, and it's going to be fantastic. And if you look at Revelation, heaven, it's a wedding banquet. Again, yeah, poor Ruth having traumatic times trying to plan her wedding banquet, but Jesus has got one laid on that's going to be fantastic. But I think if you think back over some of the great meals that you've had, maybe you're thinking about the food, but you are probably thinking about the people that you had them with as well, aren't you? I hope you are. I'm sure you are. It's probably not a meal that you had on your own. It's probably the people that you ate with as well. Probably for you, it's meals that you've prepared yourselves because you're marvellous. But maybe not. Maybe it's nice to have a meal prepared for you. So it's all about meals, and there's a richness, isn't there, and lots going on in the fellowship and the relationship that we enjoy with God. But more than that, it really is. It is just the relationship. I'm going to give you one more Japanese character to learn. Because if you read in Song of Solomon, really the sort of the highlighted passages are she's there with her lover. And in chapter, where have I got it? In 2 verse 4, it's he brought me to the banqueting house. And she talks about the banquet. But there's somewhere else where she is just absolutely delighted just to sit in his shade. That's, verse 3, just above that. With great delight, I sat in his shadow, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. I sat in his shadow, and here's another little Japanese character for you. This is a bit, I don't know whether this is really true, where it came from. It's maybe a bit cheesy explanation, but again, this is the person. You can see it's kind of similar to that. This is the person, and this is a tree, and together that's the character for rest. And so it's like as you sit in the shade of a tree, that is an image of rest. And lots kind of through the Bible that we're sitting under vines and fig trees, aren't they? They're sitting under a tree, and that is rest. And the Bible tells us, keeps telling us, doesn't it, that rest is where we're headed, that we're headed to that rest with Christ. And actually, it will just be enough to sit in his shade. At the end of the book, right at the end, when all the kind of traumas of the relationship have kind of been worked out and people are no longer kind of laughing at them, she's just walking around, the bride is walking around just leaning on her husband. And it's just that leaning, just that enjoying relationship, enjoying rest. And so that's kind of why I think, as a single woman, it's probably okay for me to read Song of Solomon and to think, actually, Christianity really is Christ. God really is delighted in me. Where I'm headed, the most important thing that I can do in a day, and this ties into you looking at quiet times next time, is just to rest. It's just to be in his shadow under the tree, is to rest in him and enjoy that relationship. God gives us lots of fantastic gifts and gives us trials as well to walk through. But actually, it's all about that relationship that we have with him through Christ and resting in that. So do take a moment to reflect on that and do write your haiku.